Good morning, members. Welcome to all present. I just in advance wish to tender an apology for Minister Mbombo that will join us a bit later. But thank you for the department as well as all members present for availing yourself for the Standing Committee on Health meeting this morning, where the department will brief us on the annual performance plan for the 2019-2020 year. I will immediately request all members to introduce themselves for the record. My name is Wendy Philander and I'm the chairperson of this committee.
Good morning, Lorraine Botha.
Good morning, Regan Allen.
Good morning, Julian Postman.
Good morning, Nayanda Burns.
Good morning, Rachel Van Vogel.
Good morning, Beth Engelbrecht, Head of Health.
Good morning, Chair and members. Simon Kay, Chief Financial Officer and Head of Corporate Health.
And good morning, Laura Angeletti Tutue, Chief Director, Infrastructure and Technical Management.
Thank you very much. Our guests at the back, please come to the microphone. Thank you.
Good morning, Eastern Apollos.
Good morning, Noma Wethu Sibukwana. I'm the MLO for Department of Health.
Good morning, I'm Lisa Lakomi. I'm the researcher for the Inspectors Committee.
Thank you. Morning, my name is Noma Ndejamkwe, Procedural Officer for the Standing Committee on Health.
Thank you very much, members. Any additional apologies that the committee needs to take note of?
An apology for Bakubaku Force. She's in hospital admitted last night.
Sorry to hear. Thank you, member. We'll definitely keep in our thoughts and prayers. Thank you. Committee, the purpose of the meeting is for us to familiarize ourselves with the program of the department and, of course, to formally meet the department and to meet the committee as well. And also we will be formulating our program going forward after the briefing by the department. So at this stage, without further ado, good morning, sir. Do you mind introducing yourself before we go ahead? You can just step to the microphone, please.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mishak, and I'm coming from the Department of Health and Strategic Planning.
Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome. Committee, I also need to inform you that the department has requested to extend the scope of the presentation in order to give us more information on the department's program, their future plans, and the annual performance plan. So I think before we start, can I just also ask the members that when it comes to questions and answers, that we please keep it as brief as possible, to the point as possible. We not repeat our questions, and then also we will break at 10:30 for a few minutes just to take a break at such, yes. So at this point in time, I'll give over to the department, and once again, thank you very much for availing yourself.
Thank you very much. So the request was that we present largely on the APP for 1920, so that will be the main gist of the focus, and I believe that the APPs have been distributed also to the members. And what Dr. Balaji is the head of strategy, he will do the presentation. And largely we will focus then on, in the APP, what is the total budget of the department of 24.7 billion, what is it that we will be buying, and how we propose the targets to be and where we are working towards. I'm sure if Minister Mbombo was here at this introductory point, she would have pointed out that this department is under tremendous pressure. There's from a burden of disease perspective and also from a financial perspective in terms of the major challenges that we do face. We're not the only one in the country, but definitely in this province we are not spared from that reality. Our budget has been decreasing in real terms over the past few years, and both the population and the burden of disease has been increasing at the same time. So this annual performance plan gives an intention how we wish to make it balance as best as possible, and that we would like to continue on our journey of having had an unqualified audit for 15 years, of which the last 3 years have been clean in finance as well. So we are very proud, and I'm very proud of the staff in this department. We are a very dispersed department with delegations for decision making at the lowest level, because we do believe that's the best way to be the best for the patients we serve. But let me hand over to Dr. Valoji. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. While the request was to focus on the APP, we thought it's a new committee and we should give you some broader picture of because the APP is just a one-year kind of plan, and we try and locate this in a bigger picture. So we're going to cover the following. I thought we should just describe what the health landscape looks like. So what is the department made up of? Then talk a bit about the planning process. In the department, we also have a long-term vision, which is Healthcare 2030. And then, as it's a new political term, we're busy doing a transformation strategy towards health sector reform, and then come to the APP so that we have a bigger context within which the APP is located. So in terms of the department, we serve about 75% of the Western Cape population of 6.6 million. So the other 25% is largely the insured population that seeks private healthcare. In the population growth, you see the slide, and there's a projection up to 2025. And you can see how the population is meant to increase over the years. This is made up of two things. One is the natural growth of the population, but also migration into the province, which is quite a significant factor. Okay. In health, we have six health districts. So it's the city of Cape Town, the metro, and then there are five rural districts. Okay. They are labeled there, and you'll see the population numbers in each of the districts as well. In the metro itself, we have eight sub-districts, and those are shown in this graph. In total, we have 32 sub-districts, so eight in the metro, and then the rest are in the rural. Conventionally, when we talk about the service delivery platform, we speak about it in a couple of ways, and this is just tries to capture that at a very high level. So if you start with the outer circle, it's community-based services. So this is really our community care workers doing household visits, etc. But in here is also school health, it's other non-medical, non-health site places where we provide a service. Then you have facility-based services. This is largely your primary healthcare clinics. And there too, there's a range of clinics. We talk about satellite clinics. We talk about providing a service sometimes in mobile, sometimes going to a town hall once or twice a week. Then you have larger community day centers. You have 24-hour services in community health centers. They are largely in the metro, but more recently, Krabo has become a 24-hour center. So it's quite a large spectrum of facilities there. Then district hospitals, which is really your first level of acute hospital care. And this largely has medical officer, family physician type care. But over the years, we have learned that in the larger hospitals, it makes good sense to also place some of our important specialities there. So if you take Khayelitsha, Mitchell's Plain, Karl Bremer, some of the bigger specialities we are specialists in these, though they are deemed district hospitals. Okay. Then you have regional hospitals, which provide the full package of care, specialist care. And then you have the tertiary hospitals, which is Red Cross Hospital, and the two central hospitals, Tigerberg and Kruderske. On the side, on my right, you see we have a category called specialized hospitals. And this is largely in four categories. It's TB, psychiatry, rehabilitation, and dental. And on my left, the specialized services, which is really the EMS and forensic pathology.
Sorry, sir, do you mind if I just stop you there? Good morning, Minister. Welcome. We have received your apology. Thank you for availing yourself.
Okay, so in terms of more specifics, you can see the number of clinics and sub-districts, the number of different hospitals. I'm not going to read through all of this. But we have 49 ambulance stations, about 250 ambulances, forensic pathology, the mortuaries. So that's the kind of a number of facilities across the department. When we look at the burden of disease, it's largely a quadruple burden. The schematic just tries to capture that at a very high level. So it's really four large burdens, and on the 12 o'clock position you see non-communicable diseases, and in this category, it's a very large category of diseases. It includes things like your diabetes, high blood pressure, all your cancers, mental illness, all of that sits, asthma, all of that sits in non-communicable diseases. In the 3 o'clock position is injuries, and the injuries are largely from two causes. It's road traffic accidents, but interpersonal violence is the other big one. And in recent times, the interpersonal violence has just really gone out of control, especially in the metro. In the 6 o'clock position is infectious diseases, and in the main, HIV and TB forms the largest part of that burden. And then in the 9 o'clock position, it's maternal, woman, and child health. So that's largely how we describe the burden in the department. Okay. So this graph shows there's a public health concept called years of life lost. That's the YLL. So which conditions takes away the most years of life, potential years of life lost? If you take the life expectancy, and which kills people at the youngest age? So you'll see at the bottom, the three largest causes of years of life lost is HIV/AIDS, interpersonal violence, and TB. Okay, so that kills our younger people specifically. Okay. In terms of health outcomes, I think we're very happy with the provincial outcomes. Clearly, there's room for improvement, but compared to the rest of the country, we do very well in terms of our health outcomes. And this graph just shows that in terms of the top three is the life expectancy, and for the province and for national, and you see our life expectancy is doing reasonably well. At the bottom there, we say under 5 mortality rate. So these are all the children under 5 years that die per year per 1,000 live births, and that's 20 for this province. At national, it's 33. Then neonatal. This is the number of babies within 28 days that pass on, and 5 is the number for the province. And then infant mortality is the number of kids less than 1 year old that died. So if you take the 20 children under 5, you'll see of that 20, a large number, 18, is less than 1 year. So the biggest number of children that we lose is less than 1 year of the under 5 category. Then in terms of the budget distribution, we have a budget of about 24 billion rand. And you'll see we have programs 1 to 8, starting at the kind of 11 o'clock position is program 1, and if you go clockwise, 88% of our budget is committed to service delivery, and these are programs 2, 3, 4, and 5. But all the proportions of our budget allocations is contained in this pie graph. From a human resource point of view, we have about 31,500 staff, 93% employed in a permanent capacity, of which 63% are health professionals, the biggest category of health professionals being nurses. We also it's largely a female-based organization, so 72% are female. Then you see the racial categorization of staff. 54% of our SMS cadre are female, and 208% deemed disabled. And then the last one shows you the age categorization of the workforce. So then I want to move on a bit about the legislative planning framework. So in the department, being a statutory government department, it's quite prescribed about how one does planning, and according to the National Treasury guidelines, there's a 5-year plan for every political term that's expected, and we're busy doing that now for the 6th administration. And at the bottom, there's an APP. Okay. So this slide here, just largely, when we plan, we need to take into account the global and the national kind of policy parameters. So at the global level, I think the Sustainable Development Goals is the one that we have to take cognizance of. In there, SDG 3 is what speaks about good health and well-being. but many of those other development goals impact on health outcomes. So that is why I think later on we'll speak a bit about the whole of society approach and affecting upstream factors, which are so important. So that's the SDGs. In the middle there is the National Development Plan. I just put it more symbolically there. The document is available if members would wish. And in there, there's a section that talks specifically about health. And more recently, the National Health Insurance, probably the largest piece of health sector reform, has come to be. And the bill is about, the revised bill is about to be released, but there's been a policy in 2017. Like I said, it's quite prescribed what goes into the APP. So this shows you there's a Part A section that has the goals and the risks and the situational analysis and the policy frameworks. And then there's a Part B for each of the programs we meant to describe all of these headings. Okay. So in the APP, and you have a hard copy, I think it's important, it's quite a rich source of information. So Program 8 has all the capital and maintenance projects listed in the APP. So if members for your constituency or you have a particular interest, you could dive in there and look at the detail. There's a section on Part C which talks about linkages to other plans, and there you will see our link to the HIV conditional grant and the infrastructure grants, etc., all described. There are two annexes. The one is, while we do a five-year plan, there might be annual amendments to the five-year plan, so then we need to be explicit about that. And then Annexure B is quite important, especially for members who are not health colleagues. You might want to understand what does this indicator mean, especially when we come to the APP. So in Annexure B, there's quite a detailed description of what that indicator means, what's the numerator, what's the denominator, what's the importance of that indicator, etc. So that's quite a nice section as well. In our last five-year plan, which was 2014 to 2019, we had two goals. One was promote health and wellness, and the second one was embed good governance and values-driven leadership practices. Okay? And under there, then there were specific outcomes we were aiming to achieve. So that's a bit about the overview and the planning process. A couple of years ago, we started the process of planning for the long term. And this, Madam Chair, is not a statutory requirement. So this is something we do in the department. And we found it very useful to think about the long term, what's the vision. And so it's been called Healthcare 2030, The Road to Wellness. And it's available. Unfortunately, we've run out of hard copies because it's a couple of years ago we've distributed all of them. But they're available on the departmental website. And this is just a rundown of the different sections. It's a very useful document because it's our reference point that we keep going back to, and it covers all of these sections. So I just want to refer to you to specific areas. The nub of the vision in 2030 is access to person-centered quality care. And that's quite a loaded statement because each one of those is important. Access is important, person-centered is important, quality is important, and care is important, and how do you give effect to each of those things. And the 2030 objective is really to kind of achieve a quality experience in a world-class public health service. And we also want to shift from a curative model to a wellness model. That's why the subheading of 2030 is the road to wellness. Mm-hmm. Okay. We did some innovative stuff in developing 2030. One of the things was, you know, we as managers and as the bureaucracy, we often write in a particular way. And people then said, well, what does this mean for the ordinary person? So in 2030, you'll see there's a section where we take the vision and we say, if you're a patient, what would you expect in 2030? How will the health service look? And we try and describe it in plain language. So we did that perspective for patients. We did that perspective for staff, for the community, for the Department of Health, for our strategic partners, and for the whole of government, so that we try and visualize what 2030 would mean for those various stakeholders. The values is quite an important journey, and in 2030 we list our values, and we've been on this journey now for several years. We think it's a very important part of our leadership and culture journey. And these are the values of the department. So it's the acronym is ICAIR squared, competence, caring, accountability, integrity, responsiveness, respect, we've added, and more recently, innovation has been a Western Cape government value as well. And I think the big thing about the values journey has been that it mustn't just be on a poster on the wall. How do you give effect to it in our daily practice? So we've done a lot of things trying to do that. We've developed the leadership behaviors charter to say, what do these values mean and how do they translate to behaviors and to actions on the ground? What would it mean? So we call that the leadership behaviors charter. That's been available. We've been doing a Barrett survey now for several years, and we've been very encouraged by the results, because over the years you will see the limiting values, which is the kind of negative aspects, has been systematically coming down. So our staff and the organization's value alignment is increasing all the time, and that's been it. We can make all of that available to the chair. In 2030, I think the principles are quite important, and yes, it's listed on this slide. So the first one is patient-centered experience, outcomes-based, because we can be busy doing lots of things. Are we impacting on the outcomes? Okay. PHC philosophy. So this one is important to clarify. When we say PHC philosophy, we're not just talking primary care clinics. That's why the word philosophy. So it's primary health care within a bigger picture, supported by the whole health system, by a referral system, by other levels of hospitals, but also an important pillar of primary health care is community engagement. That is, how do we get communities involved? An important pillar of primary health care is intersectorial work, so how do we work with other sectors? That's why it's PHC philosophy. It's not just primary care. Okay? The district health service model is an important model, tested globally, tried and tested, and we've been at it now for many years, and it's really the pillar of the health system. It would include from community-based services, primary care, up to district hospitals in the model. Equity is an important social justice principle, and we've been doing some technical work recently. And when we look at equity, we look at access to services, we look at how we spend our money and allocate resources, and we look at our outcomes. Okay. So, and then efficiency is self-explanatory, and strategic partnerships. So those are the principles. So that's 2030. Okay, and then like I said more recently, we are embarking on a departmental transformation journey, and we have to also take into account the external environment within which we are located, right? And what assumptions does one make about that external environment? So this is a set of assumptions we're making. The first one is that the population will continue to grow and migration will continue to increase towards the Western Cape. The second one is a weak economic outlook with unacceptable levels of poverty. And if we're talking about a five-year horizon, we think that that situation is still going to continue for the next 5 years. A decrease or plateauing of social spending budgets. Okay? So it's unlikely, and for the last couple of years, our budgets have been going down in real terms. We've lost about 600 million in the last 3 years. Okay? And we think for the next several years, that's probably going to continue, or at best it would stay the same, unlikely to increase significantly. A continuing volatile and complex environment, right? That's all the social ills we talk about, poverty, unemployment, violence, all of those things. Escalating size and complexity of burden of disease. So I spoke about the quadruple burden of disease, but members, I think it's very important. What we often don't have an appreciation for is what does the complexity mean? Because we look at hard numbers, you know, like at government departments, how many admissions or how many primary healthcare headcounts. But behind each number is complexity. Okay, and what we are finding in the health department is those days of having a person come in with a single condition is getting much, much smaller. Today, people come into our service with much more complex conditions. So you have diabetes, and you have hypertension, and you have kidney problems, or you've had a stroke, or you have heart disease. That's the nature. If you get children coming in, they come with malnutrition, and measles, and HIV, or TB. It's complex. And what's the implications when you get complex patients like that? Well, the implications are, for making the diagnosis, you need highly skilled professionals to make the diagnosis. you need to carry out much more sophisticated investigation, more sophisticated tests. These are the patients that stay longer in the service, and unfortunately their prognosis is also poorer. Okay. So that's the complications of having more complex people, and that's becoming the norm more and more. So I think it's important that we have an appreciation for that. Drug resistance is the other thing, in TB specifically. You're now having XDR patients, multiple drug resistance, and in fact there's a category called total drug resistance where none of the drugs we have are actually working.
Mm.
Okay. So that's another big challenge for the health department. Okay. Then the adverse impact of climate change, I mean, I think we're all kind of familiar with that, but in the health sector we've borne the brunt of that in many ways in recent times, and it's really come home to roost. So when we had the day zero situation in the Western Cape, the implications for health were quite serious. We've had fires in Nizhna recently, the Swatland Hospital was burnt down recently, so that's actually happening. Energy, load shedding, so all of those things, and we think that's going to increase going forward. So our resilience and our ability to cope with climate change and its adverse impact is an important factor. Incremental increases in the proportion of a younger workforce. So the assumption we're making is our budgets are unlikely to increase. So therefore our staff size of 31,500, we're probably going to be very much in that ballpark. But what we're finding is at the margins we have younger staff coming into the department, and with the younger staff they bring a new energy, new ways of doing things, etc. And that's a positive. I think technology has huge opportunities for doing business differently, so that's a very positive factor. And then the last one is we have to do business differently, so innovation also becomes a huge opportunity. So those are the assumptions we're making. This is a schematic that captures our transformation journey. And in here, I think it's important to identify the purpose of the department, which is really about adding public value through person-centered care and improved health outcomes. And we must always go back to our purpose and remind ourselves about the purpose. Okay? We also have a departmental pledge in the dark navy blue box at the 1 o'clock proposition. And our pledge is to really to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people, adding the greatest value, and clearly focusing on the most vulnerable, but clearly within the resources that are available. So in the transformation journey, we have three focus areas. The first one is that service needs should drive priorities, because that's what our core business is. The second one is good governance, and we talk about governance both inside the department as well as externally with our partners, be it the national department, be it with public works, be it with CEI, local government, etc., so external governance. And then the third pillar is culture change and dispersed leadership. We think that is key. And the culture, when we talk about organizational culture, we're talking about the way we do business. How do we change that? And that's quite a complex journey that we're embarking on. And leadership, we're talking about dispersed leadership, so it's not only the minister and Dr. Engelbrecht at the top, it's dispersed leadership right across the organization. How do we deepen that in the organization? So this all said and done, members, I think the key contradiction and key tension in the department is the fact that we have increasing service demands on the one hand, and we have decreasing resources on the other. And this is a tension that we're in itself. And it has huge service pressures. And members, I'm sure over your term you would like to visit some of the sites, you will see for yourself the pressures that are experienced on the ground. And our staff are having a hard time coping with that. So we really want to make that quite explicit. And then that has implications both for stress on staff, but also on quality and outcome risks. And we are starting to see some kind of early signals of outcomes being compromised in the department. So universal health care is quite important. And like I said, the NHI-UHC policy has been released, and the new policy is going to come out quite soon. When we talk universal health care, this is part of the Sustainable Development Goals. So this is a global approach. It's not just a Western Cape thing or a national thing. It's a worldwide thing. Okay? So we all clearly support the approach to universal health care. Universal health care has three parts to it. The first part is access to care. So that's the coverage component. The second one is adequate quality of care. That's the second component. And the third component is financial protection of patients in this instance, because there is a concept called catastrophic spending, where you have poor people have to raise funds to access healthcare, and that puts them deeper into poverty. So those are the three parts to universal health coverage, okay? And we completely support that. And our approach to universal healthcare is going to be three-pronged. The first one, we believe, is a health system strengthening approach. You've got to strengthen the entire health system, okay? And a lot of what I've been talking about now is that bigger health system that we have to strengthen, okay? And in this five-year period, we will be refining what our strategy is in that regard. The second plank to UHC is a policy response to this. So the bill is about to come out. What will our policy response be to that? And there are some concerns related to the bill, and we can speak about that. And then there are key roles within UHC. For example, there's a stewardship role. What does stewardship mean for the government? Now, that the World Health Organization speaks about government playing that stewardship role, where we must provide the strategic direction, we must provide inspiring leadership, and we must be able to mobilize a whole lot of players, public and private, civil society, other partners, etc. But we need to play that stewardship role. So the national department and the national minister would play that role nationally, but our minister and our department would play that within the province. Okay? But what does that mean? How do we give effect to it, etc.? So stewardship. The second one is a regulatory role. So how does one regulate the private sector and quality and all of those things? The third one is a strategic purchaser function. Okay? And what services do you buy and commodities and who does what? The fourth one is a provision of health services. So those are the five. Provision of services. So those are the roles that will be emerging, and we will be exploring all of that in greater detail. The last plank for UHC is we saying over and above the policy stuff, how do we learn from practice? Okay, so on the ground, can we start doing some things on the ground with the private sector, and let's create some innovative service delivery models and learn from that. Okay, so that's our third plan. Right? And in that third one, there's a lot of exciting new energy wanting to do, a lot of willingness to start to do that. And we've also, through the minister and the HOD, are wanting to partner with our sister provinces like the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu to see how do we collaborate around some of this. And there's been very positive responses in that regard. So when it comes to service transformation, I think bending the curve of disease coming at us is quite important, but because, like I said, we want to shift to wellness and we want to shift to prevention, otherwise we're going to be forever mopping the floor. Okay? The second one is dampening the demand on health services. When we say dampen the demand on health services members, we really want to be clear, we're not saying denying access to services. Okay? When we say dampen demand, we're talking about how do we prevent illness, so that you reduce the demand on the services. We're saying, how do you do service delivery differently so people don't have to come into the health facilities? Right? How do we create agency and self-management? Right? So with now with IT and information being much more available for basic conditions, how do people manage it themselves? You know? So those are all ways of dampening the demand, okay? But it's not denying access. Okay? And then the third one is redesigning our service delivery model. So in our going forward, okay, in a geographic area, we want to see these three areas come together: universal health coverage, community-orientated primary care, and the whole of society approach come together in each geographic area. That's going to be the thinking for the next couple of years of how we deepen that. Okay? This slide just shows the life course approach that you'll see children, adolescents, adults, and elderly. And we really, you see the direction of the red arrows. We want to increasingly move towards a healthy society, prevention, etc. Okay? Now, the whole of society approach, the Western Cape government has been at it for the last couple of years now. And the health department, the minister, and Dr. Engelbert and Dr. Kluti have been playing a key role in trying to work with other departments in this regard, and this requires a whole separate conversation, but we've got learning sites in Saldanha, Drakenstein, Manenberg, Hanover Park, and Khayelitsha, and departments are working together with local government in those areas to say how do we solve problems together, how do we jointly collaborate around this? How do we learn to do things differently? Okay, so that's all the big picture stuff, and just to give you the context, and now I want to come to the APP. And so I'm going to take you five program, and very quickly, because you could ask questions. But so program one is largely the administrative program, and the big thing here is, do we spend our entire equitable share budget, right? And we usually are very good at that. We 1% either way of our budget year in and year out. IT connectivity is quite an important thing, so we have targets for hospitals and for clinics in this area. In program two, which is probably the largest program, right, this is where we have our primary healthcare, our community-based services, primary care services, and district hospitals, also in program two. Okay? So here, a PHC utilization rate, this is what's the average number of times a person would come to use the service, and we're saying it's 2.2. Per person. Okay. Ideal clinic status rate, that's the whole quality of care improvement from the Office of Health Standards Compliance and National Department. And we started a year later on this, so but we're making very good progress. In the last financial year, we had a 68% ideal clinic status rate, and this year we want to move that up to 90%. Resolving complaints within 25 working days, we do very well in that regard as well. Okay. Then it's the district hospitals. You'll see the first one, bed utilization rate. Now, the global kind of benchmark for hospitals is 85%, okay, because you need that 15% gap to allow you to move patients around in the system and to get the right quality of care, that kind of thing. Our hospitals are sitting 90%, sometimes 100%, sometimes 110%. So we're way over above the global benchmark of it. And you see in this instance, the district hospitals are 90% plus. Average length of stay is self-explanatory, complaint and expenditure. Okay. Then in program two, we also have programmatic indicators. So these are HIV, TB, right, and ART retention. So this is what proportion of patients still remain in care after 12 months of having started on treatment. And you see there, it is 60%, 63% is our target for this year. This is a concern. Okay? So that means we lose 40% of our patients, 4 out of 10, having started on ART, then start to default or get lost to follow-up. That's very high. Okay? So the department is trying to work out how we do better on that front. Okay? Having put a lot of energy screening people, diagnosing people, starting them on treatment, and then 4 out of 10 fall off the system. TB, loss to client, you see it's 11%. So almost 11 out of 100 patients also default on TB treatment. So loss to follow-up and default in treatment is a big area of concern. Our TB success rate, we want to aim for 81%. The WHO recommends 85%, and it's work in progress to get there. Then when it comes to maternal and child health, our maternal mortality ratio, we're aiming for 60%. Antenatal first visit before 20 weeks, again, it's another important marker. And we would like to get to 100%, but we're at 30% at the moment. Immunization coverage, very important indicator. In the APP, you'll see specific immunization coverage for measles and other vaccines. This is a total immunization coverage for 1 year. Okay? And then we're very proud of that fourth one in the 5 o'clock position there, infant first PCR test positive. This is really about the babies that are positive, HIV positive, born of HIV positive mothers. And this has been a dramatic reduction over the years thanks to the ART program. So we're really now sitting at 0.3-0.5%, which is very, very good nationally and globally. Other maternal and child indicators, the couple year protection rate, this is really a reproductive health service indicator. So it's a complex indicator that takes condoms and all the other kind of measures into reproductive health services, and it combines it into this. Cervical cancer screening, we want to aim to get to close to 60%. Diarrhea case fatality rate, and then school grade 1 learners screened. Okay. Members, I have just to draw your attention, I have drawn a snippet of some of the most important indicators. In the APP, you have other more detailed indicators. I haven't put all of them in the slides. But we then move on to program three, the number of ambulances. So we want to just draw your attention to these are the number of rostered ambulances, right? But the number of ambulances that are on the road that we have staffing for, okay, is much lower than this. Okay? And that's from a variety of reasons. The budget is one of them, but more importantly has been the violence in communities and the effect of post-traumatic stress disorder on staff and other factors. So that's a real challenge in EMS. The number of cases attended to is listed there. And then we have an indicator of how many cases do we respond to within 15 minutes, right, in urban areas. So that's the priority one calls, okay? And you see there we want to aim for 50%. Now we should be aiming for much better, okay? But given all the challenges we face in EMS, that's where we're sitting at the moment. And I suppose it makes for a more specific conversation. But given the gangsters and the violence in specific areas, they've been declared red zone areas. And in those areas, our ambulances have to be escorted by the police to actually go and fetch a patient. And that has dramatically increased the response time to those cases. Mm-hmm. And that's just where we are in the society and communities. In the rural case, because of the larger distances, the marker is rural response under 40 minutes. So then move on to program four, which is really your regional hospitals and all your specialized hospitals. And again, these are the markers for that, so I'm not going to read all of them. And then the dental hospitals, we have specific markers for those. Mm-hmm. Central hospitals, so these are now your Tigerberg and Krudersky. And you can see the markers are the same for different categories of hospitals. The target might be a bit different. But again, you'll see central hospitals are also above the 85% mark. This is Red Cross Hospital, that's deemed a tertiary hospital. Quality of care for patients is quite important, and we speak about quality of care and we talk about those markers. I won't read all of that, but our patient satisfaction rate at the moment is 86%. Program 6 is a health science and training program, and you see the number of bursaries we award is increased for 1920. The number of interns has gone up, and then the community-based care workers for training. Program 7 is healthcare support, and here we have our linen laundered, right? We have outsourced and we have insourced. We have our in-house laundries, and then we also outsource for that, and their cost average cost per item laundered is there. We have an energy reduction program and a commitment to reduce the amount of energy we consume, and we've put markers in the APP. We have a similar benchmark for water as well. Then in program 7.3, forensic pathology, which is also under tremendous pressure, one of the important things is child death reviews, right? So every child death that actually happens, we conduct a multidisciplinary review around that, and we want to make sure we get to 100% of those. Program 8 is the health facilities program, and here maintenance and capital works and all of them are covered, including health technology, which is all your medical equipment that we spend on those. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, health is quite a complex business, as you would have gathered from this presentation, and I think this is a very high level, and should the committee feel we needed a deeper dive into specific areas, we can always schedule that over a period of time. The important thing is point three, which is we often see health as a kind of consumption thing. It's a thing that just consumes money. Okay? But the points that are in this slide here just brings out the fact that health is quite an important part of the economy. And it has a much broader function. Okay. So we employ 31,000 staff plus, another 3,500 community health workers through NGOs. Our goods and services, we spend about 7 billion rands on goods and services, which is a sizable contribution to the economy. Okay. We create opportunities for hundreds of intern graduates. Then we provide the service platform on which health professionals are trained. So So we partner with the universities and the nursing colleges, etc., because we provide the service delivery platform for them. And of course, if you want a productive health for workforce, you need good health. So it's a very fundamental thing. If you want good performance in schools, you need healthy children. So we have a much, and globally, the estimates are that the return on investment for health is sixfold. So this is not us saying this, this is the United Nations and other colleagues saying that. The transformation journey that we're on is an important process, and the key thing is over the last 25 years, we've put in a lot of effort, we've got very good outcomes, we've got very good systems, but now we face real threats in terms of budget cuts, the environment, etc. And how do we sustain those gains is an important thing. Like Dr. Engelbert mentioned, we've got quite a track record in terms of audits, and we need to maintain that. That gives confidence not only to government but also to the public, and we need to continue to do that. I think in the immediate period, three major opportunities emerge. The first one is information technology creates huge opportunities of doing business very differently and more efficiently and effectively. Then the whole of society approach to advocate for broader change to impact on the upstream determinants of health. And then the last one is universal health coverage is a new opportunity to work with the private sector and do business differently. But the point we want to make is that we're operating in quite a fragile environment, and there's a lot of pressure on this department, and it could be easily tipped over, so we've got to really be very vigilant about how we manage this department. But we're on a journey, exciting journey, lots of good opportunities, but also high risk and tough times ahead. Thank you very much. I'd like to also just acknowledge, I think we also need to remember why we are doing what we are doing, and that's for the patients. The picture of a patient in one of our communities. Dr. Perez is the chief director for Metro, Dr. Engelbert, our HOD. I'd just like to acknowledge Meshek sitting right here, who did a lot of the slides for this. Thank you very much, Meshek and Rafika. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. So I think it was quite a mouthful, a very comprehensive and thorough briefing. I like the closing sentence as of "we must not forget why we are doing what we are doing." Much respect for the department. Colleagues, if you can agree at this point in time, we give our Minister Mbombo an opportunity to give her introductory remarks, which we will then open the floor for questions at this point. Minister, welcome once again. Over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Apology for being late. I think, Chair, because I don't know what was the introduction from the HOD, and also because we have done quite a long presentation, probably let me just allow for the questions, and then I'll take the question from that side, because I don't want to do the repetition and then we deny people questions for rushing for time. Let's do it like that, and then I can do the conclusion, closing remarks.
Okay, sure. Thank you,
Minister. You know that I can talk.
Thank you so much. Colleagues, the floor is now open for your questions. Remember, way at the beginning, we agreed on keeping it to the point. Member Gillian, then Member Botha.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think my question is sort of linked to universal health access. Just in terms of the type of partnership that the department envisages with the private sector, what type of partnership is that going to be? And what has been the attitude of the private sector, and the willingness of the private sector to partner? And I think I want to be a little bit more specific and say, not the private sector as in companies that supply goods to the department, because we know that they've come on board in some partnerships, and I saw Minister Mbombo has sort of shown some of that work, but specifically the private medical hospitals.
Thank you, Chair, and I also welcome the very comprehensive presentation, and I must say that there are a lot of great that happens in this department, and I want to then ask the flip side of it. How is it then that this department still takes in the media so much flack for the pockets of negatives that happens. And then I want to ask, is there an increase, Dr. Valapchi spoke about the pressures and the staff pressures, is there an increase of staff that access ICAS or psychological support for them to render the service that they do, and in the environment that you have sketched, is there an increase in that? Thank you.
Member Barnes and then Member Allen.
Thank you, Chair. I'm partly covered by the Honourable that have spoken now, because my question was mostly on the staff, the stress staff, and the service that is kind of rendering down. It's something visible that you can see within the department, the stress level that is there. Now, what I would want to know is, I also heard on the presentation the decrease of resources. What is the plan in the decreasing of resources? Yes, the staff are stressed, resources have decreased, but what is the plan? I've heard that there's a policy response. We also know that policy won't be responding to what's happening there now. What are we going to do about what is happening now? And then another thing that triggered me was the outsourcing of the linen. If we are in so much problems, why can't we keep it as a department and do our work ourselves? Why do we still outsource rather than saving? That's my question. I thank you.
Thank you, Member.
Good morning. Thank you for the comprehensive presentation. And being new to the portfolio, please forgive me if my questions are... So on page 28, you spoke about the service pressures, and you mentioned the quality and outcome risk, and you mentioned that there's outcomes that are compromised. Are you able to elaborate on that one? And then on page 30, I appreciate the fact that there's a dampening on the demand for services. I would like to hear more of that. What innovative ideas or strategies are in place in order to dampen the demand on services? But also in a more personal one, and you spoke about the 15-minute and the red zone. What communication has been taking place between your department and, if it's community safety or SAPS, in order to make that a more practical way of handling it? Because yes, SAPS will be busy, or it will take 45 minutes. And I spoke to and thank you for the minister who replied when I was in Manenberg, and it was such a matter happening, and the person was waiting, and due to it being a red zone, we had to wait 35 minutes, which was still quick, I think. But is there any communication, and where, if there's a breakdown in that, and how is that being catered for in order to reach that 15-minute call time? Thank you.
Thank you, Member Allen. Member Van Vogel.
Thank you, Chair. My question will be on the statement by the HOD. She mentioned in a statement about the COPC healthcare workers going into communities. Now, my question, therefore, is what I want to know is the number of healthcare workers that you have in the department, and what are the plans to integrate them into to government. Then my second question is on the MEC's, first sentence, she mentioned something, I think some of our members also mentioned that, the severe service pressure on our staff. Now, if I look at the closing of the GF Chester Hospital, doesn't it contribute to service severe service pressure on KDH and Mitchell's Plain District Hospital? So, what plans are in place to address these challenges?
Thank you, Member. Welcome, Member of the AFF. You must now first announce yourself before you ask any questions.
My name is Melika Xhego. No, mine is very brief. On the issue of the challenges facing the ambulance service. Now that it has been noted in terms of distance, that there is a serious challenge regarding distance and picking up of people, then what is the plan going forward to be able to cap that? And secondly, is the issue of the complaint resolution that because as far as what the report is saying and what you actually get when you literally make a visit to these institutions, people complain a lot. And I just want to understand that the accuracy of the information that is given there in terms of complaint resolution, because our people complain a lot because they would go to hospitals or to healthcare facilities and they would claim that they would have access to nurses and all that, but to have the direct inspection by doctors is a serious challenge. So how do we go about it?
Thank you very much, member. I think that wraps up the first round of questions. I will allow for follow-up questions. So either the department or minister are welcome to respond now. Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to respond those that I could do, starting with a UHC question. I think as Dr. V indicated that UHC it's an international. It's actually it's long overdue. There are countries actually that they have already been implemented, but in different format. In the UK, National Health Services, for example, it's been there. In the France, in terms of their social security system. In Japan, and in Ghana. But it, as I'm saying, that it's done differently, where you have got one entire health system and then with a different service providers. In terms of the partnerships and so forth, and we are talking generally because it hasn't been implemented in South Africa anyway. The gripe, it's regarding to the vehicle or the means towards the UHC, which in the national government has identified the NHI as the vehicle. But when you find, once you get the bill for the province, you'll find that the more is actually on one aspect of the towards the UHC, which is the funding mechanism. It doesn't talk about the services, which is what people are geared to. Anyone, privately, they are keen for UHC because they understand, even if they service the minimum of the population, but especially now with the high unemployment, there are many people, even for those who have got medical aid, they can even not even afford. And also the issue of the regulations, because as you know that they are the player, they are the referee, they are the whatever when it comes to the administration of the medicines and so forth. So I've never met any private. We are also in partnership with the South African Health Association Board, Hospital Board Association of the private. I've never heard anyone who's against UHC. People are against on the NHI, which is 0.1% of the landmark towards the UHC. That's the point. So that's why for us, for Western Cape, we said to the national, we are keen to be made a laboratory where they can test whatever they want to test for the UHC. We are very keen. Hence, on the 5th of September, we'll have a consultative forum, which is part of our Kotali public-private health forum, but specifically now we'll be dealing with the UHC. So we are keen. And the mere fact that the department, the national department, even endorse our initiative of working with the Eastern Cape and also the KZN. We have already have got a draft concept in the previous term. I've had a conversation with the new MECs, so they are very keen. I think the next one, because it was me who hosted last time, the Eastern Cape MEC will be the one who will be hosting, where they at the time, they also identify, I think, the BCM and also parts of the King Dalinge, but it might change in terms of the site. So there is an interest. And also private, there are even within the, remember, the public private hospitals are being licensed by the provincial
tough. So there is a sort of a relationship already that is there, not only in terms of the licensing, but also in terms of undergoing some spot checks, in terms of the inspectorate and so forth. However, the issue is about there's no legislation within the national system or policy-wise to be able that they can be account in terms of the clinical outcomes within the province. Henceforth, as we are saying, will be the provincial stewardship, where it was at the end, actually, in terms of the constitution and the current National Health Act, the provincial health is responsible for the total health of the people in that province, including even the private, in the sense that if there's someone complains about the private, or there's a compromise of the health state, even for the whole public good, the provincial minister has to intervene. So the attitude is there, good, when it comes to UHC. But the issue is the NHI. That's why I'm saying that once now the bill comes to the legislation, probably we might be invited also to say something around that. So you can see where are the issues related to some shaky ground. Why are we taking some lot of flack around that? I'm not sure what is the introduction, but if we would make an example with a school, within the education system, basic education, they are in charge of, they are responsible from age 6, grade R now, up to age 18, 19 in matric. And it's only during the school hours. So anything that is happening after 5 or during the weekends, or if you are 20 or you are 4, has got nothing to do with the school. During the school holidays, everyone goes to sleep peacefully when there is no school in terms of education. Everything is closed, even if they have got their own workshops and whatever, but it's closed, they're not responsible. But when it comes, again, with the social development, for example, although they might be responding to a crisis that has happened, that there's a child that has been neglected and so forth, but mostly they are focusing on those ones, if it was for the grant, who meet the requirements to get a child grant, or who meet the requirements to get an old age grant, or if they have to respond as I indicated. But generally, everyone sleeps after 5. And then if probably others on holidays, sort of, there's a kind of things going slow. Same applies with the housing. With the housing, it's only when you meet the requirements of the policy in terms of your income and so forth. Any other person who doesn't have a house, you are earning 40,000 or whatever, it's not a problem of the housing. But when it comes to health, you are responsible for the unborn child that we have never even seen, who's not even at your facility, to the oldest person, 100-year-old, who's not even at the facility, who's not even a patient, but might be sitting somewhere in someone's NGO or at your home, including the deceased. Those dead bodies in mortuary are responsible for them. 24 hours, 7 days, 365 days, it doesn't close. Hence, in terms of the head count, where in a person's lifetime, for example, under 5, how many times an under 5-year-old attends the clinic? Not even within that 5 each and every year, but even within the 6 months period, a child will go immunization, a child will be coughing, a child will be at school still responsible, wherever the person is. A young person who's at university might be ill or might go for the family planning, might whatever. So when we say about 14 million of the people we see at the primary healthcare services, we are not even including those who are at the hospitals. Because these people, they come now and again throughout. Now, in addition, during my time when I was a clinician, a health professional, at least when the person comes at the clinic, it might be probably presenting with diabetes only. And then we'll have the whole of 10, 20 minutes, even scanner and talk about the weather and everything about. But now, the Auntie Sarah presents with diabetes, hypertension, arthritis, depression, anxiety, has got a child who's on TK, has got a child with a teenage pregnancy, whilst coming to the clinic was nearly shot, and all of those. you're supposed to be spending so much time so that you get more, even the psychological or whatever, but you don't. Those 20 minutes average that we used to spend, now it shrinks up to that level where even the 10 minutes in the consultation that you mentioned, that 10 minutes or so in the consultation, you have to make it a point that you do the right thing. But the Auntie Sarah might be sent for the blood, take blood, go for the x-ray, because it's got the whole of the cocktail of the diseases. Go to the whatever, you have to come back, the psychiatrist will be whatever, no, you'll be referred, whatever. So, meaning even that head count of one patient is actually about 10 patients. So, my point is about, you will always take a flag, because you'll never make anyone happy if you are being seeing more than 14 million. Per day, in one clinic, they see about 100. So, at what extent that you could make the 100 happy? There's no way. So that's why I will understand that there are always the people who will be dissatisfied, which is, in some cases, it's justifiable. But what matters is about how do you respond to that. Do you dismiss their truth? No. Because you cannot now, when Auntie Sarah from Marysburg is calling that I've been sitting there in the clinic and there's a nurse who has got a biased attitude and whatever, and then you say, but our health outcomes are good. We have got the clean audit. No. She doesn't know about those damn clean audits. What she knows is about one nurse who's always rude to her. And the 12 hours or the 5 days that she has been turned away and so forth. So that's why what's important is how we respond. So some of you know that they'll just text me and then immediately to her, and then immediately there's a response. Of course, some of our flaws is about not communicating. Like you ask something about, at what extent that you communicate to the patient when the patient calls for an ambulance, when there's an expectation that ambulance must be now, and then do you inform that actually it can take about an hour or so that the person doesn't keep on complaining. At what extent you will tell that, please call again, something like that. So there will always be some negative stuff about that. For example, in the Gauteng, the issue of the mummy who was tied under the yes, it's bad, but it's because you only saw that, well, there might be as many who are tied. So that's why I've never said anything about life as demeaning, because life as demeaning could be, might have been, happening not only here, in any other provinces. Because it's a situation where the motive for the minister then was about, why should we spend per head count of, let's say, 1,300, when we could be able to render the same service by whatever, because these are institutionalized patients. But unfortunately, it's a how part. But if the principle is any other province would have done the same principle. So that we might be sitting here and then we hear that there's been an accident, 20 people in a bus accident, whatever, somewhere. The question would be, when they go to Woodstock, is N1, is the system strengthened? Is it ready to receive those? So that's the point that we're trying to make. There will always be those kind of the unforeseen kind of. With the staff, I feel sorry for the staff. I made an example at the time that some of us, actually, they are all clinicians. They are all been clinicians, so they know what we're talking about. It's not all about the money, all of us. All of us, we have been there in the cold face. We know how it works. When you go to these facilities, understandable, they'll say, Minister, if we could have extra staff and so forth and all of that, we'll want to appoint more. We'll want to. We get an equitable share that actually, when I was looking now, the depressing thing about the budget, the health sector, because I'm not only talking about only for the province, throughout, the health sector has lost about 9 billion in terms of the budget. And it's going to lose more because now there's been a cut of the provincial budgets by 5%, 5-6%. When there was the issue related to the wage bill increase, that's unfunded for in terms of the increase, but the health sector and other public services, they have to absorb all of those. For example, currently, for us now going to the province, for this 2021, using our baseline, with a 5% reduction for 2021, that means 926 million. That equates to, and you put all of this together with the 3 years that we have lost, 151 in the past, the first year, 144, 307, which end up 602 million, the whole of it is going to be 1.3 billion. And remember, the patients are going, coming in, they are increasing in numbers, and the more they are unemployed, the more they are going to be sick, and the more they're getting poorer, the more they'll be sick, the more they'll be dependent on the public services, the more they'll have a cocktail of diseases. With a crime happening, it's not only about those who get shot or get stabbed, but the family, the community itself, they get depressed, anxiety with all what is happening. They come to us. That's why I always say that whilst you might be excited that, oh, there's a show coming, there will be rugby that is being played in a stadium, all that 26,000, some of them will end up in New Somerset Hospital, EC. Whether they are distressed or their high blood pressure is increased or they've been some fight. So everything is a pain to me, to us. So that's why for us we find that there's nothing called a holiday. So the psychological support is being offered. So that's why I've got a project that says caring for the carers. Remember, our health professionals, because they might be doctors and nurses on the spotlight, but there are more than 10 categories of health professionals. The pharmacists, when people are waiting in their waiting room. The x-rays, when people say that I've been sitting, I mean the radiographers and ultrasonographers and so forth. OTs, occupational therapists, psychologists that are working even in the psychiatry units. We've got a lot of these. So that's why part of it is about, because we've got these health calendar days, that are the day of the pharmacist, the day of the radiography, the nurse's day and so forth. We must always keep on acknowledging them. Same applies within the medicine, not only general the doctors, the specialists in the trauma surgeons, for example, where they are complaining about the effect of crime, how much they spend, the depression they get when they've got these 16-year-olds with 20 bullets pumped where they have to save this child and so forth. It's all depressing. Anyway, stress and stuff, it's part of that. Outsourcing of union, you can talk about that. Service pressures, I think I've just mentioned that to Ellen in terms of some of these dampening of the services and so forth. Now, we found that there are also some parts of the, rationing? Yes. Where we find that there are times where, when a premature baby is born, where we find that in terms of the weight, you will be, you have to do some measures to save, let's say 500 grams and so forth. But as things go, based on the clinical evidence, we'll find that some of those who ended up not being able to save, you just let the child, I'm just making some examples. The spine, the head injuries. Head injuries where we'll find that because of some of, especially the young ones who've involved in the accidents, in the fights and whatever, there were times where even if the clinical prognosis showed that this person might not be able, will just be breathing. I don't want to use those words, they use the medical words. We'll find that there's nothing, they won't be able to resuscitate if things go, he or she will never be able to survive except to breathe. She can't do anything. So at what extent now we have to incubate throughout and so forth. So there are many of those things where, clinically speaking, the other things that is so common is the issue related to dialysis, where the doctor will say that you are 30 or you are 50, you in order for you to survive, those who have got the kidney failures, is to be dialyzed. So now, clinically speaking, remember, we make management decisions based on the clinical decision as advised by the experts on the field, where they will say that if now the person has got all other chronic conditions and so forth, and also is unlikely that will survive the transplant, kidney transplant. So therefore, what's the use of putting on permanent dialysis, because it's on a daily basis, versus the one where they will get a transplant or transplantable. So there are many of those things where you have to rob Paul and pay Pauline. Unfortunately, these are international interventions that are happening. But now and again, they will advise us based on the, not only for the Western Cape expertise, but nationally and internationally. So we use those kind of with the EMS. I think they're going to talk about that. But there's a turnaround strategy now that is going to be put in place. But again, NPNB, it doesn't mean that because it's about are you doing something whilst you understand that the status quo is still going to be deteriorating because of the resources? We have to do something for the anti-SARA. It cannot be that you, especially in the rural areas, where you still have to wait longer, like making an example for the Slang Refill, where you wait longer in the Slang Refill compared when you're in the river states, those kind of things. Also, in terms, there are things that are beyond our control, where, for example, they say that they are shooting somewhere in Manenberg, and actually it's a live shooting, they can see it. While the ambulance might be on standby, but at what extent that now our staff, because they are humans, could be able to be there. But there are those that where you find that it's a no-no, as I'm making an example, especially in the rural areas. Hence, we did have the safety plan together with the city for the metro, and also with the SAFs. We are also, our staff, they are also part of the SAFs in that desk with the city and the TMC, transport and so forth, with the neighborhood watches, they are part of that, because the neighborhood watches normally are the ones who often pick up very early that there is going to be fight and so forth. In the rural areas, it's mostly the Chicago, in the Pearl East, the Avian Park in the Brede Valley, where you'll find that there are a lot of some of the issues related to the safety. But generally, you find that it's mostly with the distances. But the part of the training and creating awareness, empowering the people, the EMS also, they do train ordinary community members on emergency first response as a part of like a first aid in terms of the response, so that whilst you are waiting for an ambulance, they should be. But some of the challenges, but we have worked with the farmers around that, you find that they'll call the ambulance and then you go to that farm. But to bring the person now from the ace to the gate, it's another kilometer when the gate is closed. So that's why sometimes we find that the delay is not necessarily as we're not there, but it's because that it's a distance from the house to the gate, where it's a gated community. Community of workers. I think they will respond around that to the community of workers, but noting going to the UHC, Mamo Van Focher, going to the universal health coverage, the providers of care, they will be they'll be tenderized. Anyone can provide care. So the language of integration and whatever, because actually there'll be lesser of the us doing the actual care. It could be, for example, where they say that who can offer a service related to, I'm just making a stupid example, a service related to home-based care. So it will be tenderized whatever the purchaser is and then buy directly to the service provider. So that's why that you mustn't focus on why are we putting things together, because with the UHC, it must be different kind of service providers, as long that they understand what are the specs. And also you must understand that when he mentioned that the sixfold in terms of the benefits of the returns in investment in health, there are also other benefits related that when it comes to the health, it's an economic development. I think he mentioned the infrastructure and the innovation, but economic development in relation to some of these NGOs, they are owned by women themselves who cannot compete probably to make bottles or to make devices, fancy ones. But all they can be able to capable to do, most of them, is about in the area of the catering, in the area of the being home-based carer. So they are owning that. So they are getting those. So you must be careful of looking only from one side when the economic development, it benefits women. But the issue of the equality, I'm talking about the gender equality. Also gender equality, although they've mentioned the issue about they've got more females and whatever, but as a service provider, with the $7 billion that we spend on goods and services, you find that it's still more of being male in terms of who owns, because they've already been there at first. But in the space of the NGO, I think we've got about 6,000 or so of the NGOs, home-based carers and so forth, will find that the majority of them are women and they are appointing women. And going to service to AUHC, some of those who are community health workers, they may actually even form their own weather corps and whatever to have an opportunity to be also in the economic space. But generally speaking is that when we started with a ward-based community health workers program, which the national prescribed as according to part of the negotiated service delivery agreement in the previous term. For us, we said that primary health care, it talks about community participation and development and intersectoral collaboration. That is the core of it. It mustn't be the only ones who are supposed to be there. You must empower those ones at that bottom, at the bottom. Plus also the people who know the people who, when they visit, whether it's a cancer patient, are they mummies, Auntie Sarahs who stay in that area? So what kind of opportunity that they could be able to do what they do, they can access without necessarily being confined in terms of the routine that's supposed to be, that government does. Because one might be appointed by the government but end up doing a lot of things. Also the experience in other provinces, KZN, I used to be a consultant for the KZN when I was working in my previous life. I'm the one who also part of who initiated the Sisonke, the whole of they are strong in terms of community-based care. But the mistake we did is to put all the contract workers under the PESA. Now they've got the bloated service. They cannot appoint some those professionals that are needed because they are still categorized as the whole of the health. So now you want to appoint specialists, you want to appoint another whatever, specialty, whatever, but now we have got the whole of them. Initially it was a good thing, but when it comes to a service delivery, you need a skills mix of all health professionals. Each and everyone is supposed to have their own thing, so that's where they are. As a result now, going forward, that's why now the national ministers, they've turned it around that no, don't appoint them, but just give them a one-year contract. Because we have to add another layer, because for us we said that if we could have some whatever, add another layer of services and so forth. So that's why they are not even appointed now. They've paused about that, because going to UHC, there will be service providers on their own. They can set their own monies and whatever, all of those. So that's where we are going. It's a default position. Now, when you decommission, it was never closed. When you decommission a hospital, it will have an impact anyway. However, you must understand what is the history beyond that. Yes, initially, when it was being decommissioned, it was based on the CSIR research, where it shows that, because if you recall, you're from Solander. Okay. So the metro ones will understand. That site, that Jewish day, used to be an old age home. It was an old age home building. And then when it ended up being a hospital, it ended up not being enough, and then they have to keep on adding extra. So it used to be, although it might be a field, but it ended up when the CSSR found that actually the building not only conducive for health, but you find that in the, like in the theaters, the ceiling, they were damp, and then it will have been end up a hazard in terms of the infection. Also, when you enter the entry for the ambulance and the entry for the people in terms of entrance is the same thing, which is wasn't supposed to be like that. And then when you go to the wards, in some of the, especially the outside wards, you add more pieces. If you have been to KTC, you see the KTC pieces. You see the disadvantage when you end up adding pieces and pieces on a main thing which is old. That's what it ended up. So it was based on the CSSR that one needs to be demolished. It's a must because it has got a potential hazard. In terms of the packages, there were no women, there were no children that were services that were offered there. Mostly it was more on the injuries. So there was no maternity, there was nothing. So people still have to go to maternity, Mowbray, and the children have to go wherever elsewhere. So as the people now are having children, so it had an impact on that kind of the groupings. So when it was about it needs to be demolished and build another one, the communication was about going to build a district hospital, which is a level one. If you probably don't understand it, I normally say that it's like a primary school level. level ones are the Kailichas, Mitchell's Plain, Westphalia, False Bay, and so forth. Level two, New Somerset, George, Rooster Park, sort of. Level three is the Grooteskill and Tigerberg. So it was a level one. So we are going to rebuild another level one on the same site. But as we have heard that people increasing, different kind of the packages of disease and so forth. And then based on the business case, that's when they realize actually you need a bigger one with a more specialization, because level two is a specialization and everything. So you need a bigger, more beds. Instead, I think it was 100 beds. Yes, it was 100 beds. Actually, you need more. We cannot now repeat the 100 beds in that kind of area. Because remember, there's the Gugule too, there's the whatever, the all of that area. And then when now it was discussed that now you need at least a level two, we find that for the level two, you have to go about 500 or so. And then that site is 3 hectares, 3.4 something hectares. And then you'll need about 7, double. And then in that space, it meant that you have to go up 20 floors or whatever, which is, you cannot do that. And therefore, that's when now it changed to be a level two, which is supposed 500 plus beds with all the specialization and the training for become a teaching hospital and all of those. Therefore, we need a bigger site. Hence the delay. So currently where we are now, we're in the phase four. So in the phase four, we've done what we have done now is about where the business case went to the national in terms of the funding and so forth. And in between, we have to negotiate the site. We are not responsible for identification of the site. We are not responsible for the building. It's a public works. For us, as a client, we just send them their needs, and then they discuss with whoever around that. But for us, in between, that's what we've been doing. And then in and out, the document and so forth, but now where is the level four, is it a concept? So it's where now the concept is there and they are working on it. Once we are ready, we will be, what we normally do, we go back to the community, and then now we've got something that they can even see in terms of the plan and whatever, all of those. So it has never been closed, it has been decommissioned. I think I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. We need to take a break now, colleagues. I'm sure after that there cannot be any follow-up questions.
That's why I didn't want to speak.
Yes, definitely, so that we have, in the most broadest of terms, has received answers in that instance. We need to break now, but I wanted to excuse the department and the minister now after the break. But there's only one question that I need to ask, and I think it's important as well, that in terms of the money that will go or be sourced for NHI purposes, what does the department or minister, or if you can answer as well, anticipate, what will the impact on that be in terms of our services? And what Minister Botha also mentioned earlier. Member Botha, a lot has been done, but you also find lots of complaints. But when you see what you do and where our money goes, and in terms of service delivery, one can really be satisfied, I think, and that is my personal view, as to what is happening within the department. So how do you anticipate that impact of budget cuts? Of course, the money has to come from somewhere. How will it impact us in the province? Of course, we don't operate in isolation, so it will have an impact. So what do you anticipate will it be? In 3 minutes, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the first aspect is when people complain, it is when the difference between expectation and experience that determines the level of satisfaction. So on the one hand, the expectation of people in South Africa is the Netcare and the Mediclinic and those places. And those entities have got more than 6 times the funding that we have. Mm. So we need to work on both the expectation and on the experience. Mm. So we work very hard on the experience, and Dr. Banerjee has indicated the level of satisfaction that people have. But they do complain. In general, they wait. We know patients wait.
Yes.
And how do we engage it? That is Minister Mbombo's point. The issue of the budget is a true matter. So Dr. Banerjee has indicated, so over the past 3 years, we've lost as a department 1.2 billion. Mm. And that is irrespective of the money that we contributed to Treasury to help us buffer the impact of the global economy of this country, unfortunately. Going forward, all of us know what the economy looked like, and at the moment it seems like it'll go down even further. So the balancing trick is how to keep the services going, how to keep staff at least satisfied and committed, and we've got the most amazing staff, and how do we deal with patients, and how do we deal with community and societal factors that actually drive that. And I think that is Minister's point. We are stewards for health. So we have to influence education, we have to influence safety, we have to influence economic development, we have to influence a lot of sports, arts and culture. Do your thing whilst we deal with what comes our way. And that partnerships are very strong. But ultimately, we need to get communities to take ownership of the health. But the Valerie pointed out, a patient on treatment for HIV, for example, after 12 months, we are losing a large number. We know that many of them go to the Eastern Cape. We know that. And the data elements are starting to pick that up. But there's also people that just go to another clinic and start working on our information system to pick it up. So I think it's better than the figure is, but it is a risk. So we have to work on various ways. The most critical thing, what we've decided, and I said that in my introductory comment, is to work on the leadership development so that the people at front of the clinic can take the best decision where they are for the patients, that they feel empowered to do that. And our whole system is geared towards the front line to make them, to support them. And if they have to have ICAR support, we provide the ICAR support. It has been increasing, and it's not only the pressure of numbers. What the clinicians are complaining about, or not complaining, what their experience is that it is the waves of illness and poverty and all of those waves that come, and their conscience of having to deal with them. They know when I discharge this patient, the patient goes to the same circumstances. So how do we deal with that? And then on top of that is safety. The biggest risk in our staff at the moment is safety. Where they work in clinics, that's why Hanover Park, we've closed it for 24-hour services. We cannot allow our staff to work there. That's why ambulances, we just say, look, your safety is our priority. You don't go into a red zone unless you're accompanied by it. So it is a, and very often those people in the red zones, they need the ambulance service the most. So it's a lot of conflict that staff have to deal with on a daily basis. And we as managers have to say that we see that. We know that. How do we give you support? How do you make you feel safe? And Dr. Angeliti de Tooy, from an infrastructure perspective, also, how can we use infrastructure to support safety? Our collaboration, we've got brilliant relationships with community safety, with SAFs and all of these. How can we, as a team, with education, with neighborhood watches, how can we make the staff feel safe? So it's a big challenge, and I'm very glad that the committee has picked that up.
Any closing remarks from your side, Minister?
five
seconds.
We must not close. We take a break now. We go for tea, then we come back. We're not excusing them. Excusing them.
No. There's no problem. Minister?
No, plenty. No, I think there was a question.
Members?
Yeah, Jefferson, I guess at last meeting.
Minister,
Ek is a blast, matey, and I'm not going to sleep well if I don't ask my minister to MBC this question. You mentioned in a report something about 91.5%. Yes. Now my question is, farm workers, are they included in that percentage? Because really, that's a concern for me.
Is that the last one?
Yes, that's the very last one.
the reason that I jumped that when you were asking was me, I'm a plasma mason. She knows. And the department knows that, how I'm so much into for the access, for the especially for those. The reason why I've got an obsession with the rural or farm antisaras. When they define, okay, for them, government, especially for Western Cape definition, actually Western Cape is not defined as rural, but it's more farm compared to the rural, let's say, in the Eastern Cape. Look at the difference. In the Eastern Cape, for example, or Limpopo, we say rural. The auntie has got her house here. The others have got their houses and whatever. But you'll find that it's not a gated community. Anyone can come and auntie can go freely to go to a service. When there's an improvement of the roads in the area and whatever water, the auntie can feel there's government here. Government has been here. And then when there's an imbizo by the chiefs, she forms part of the decision so that we don't want this road and whatever. But here in the Western Cape, both of the farming community, the majority are in the gated community. So gated in the sense that in the farm. So the improvement on the road, it doesn't necessarily impact on the auntie because she doesn't even drive. She doesn't even walk. I mean, most of the time, probably the farm is still the way she, in terms of the actual land or farm where it's inside. So she doesn't see that. So meaning that you'll find that the average is about only 60% or even lesser of the farming communities that are accessed by government directly. The others, they are the ones that are the auntie inside. However, having said that, the only guarantee government service that the auntie feels, remember they don't have a differentiation whether it's a local or whatever, or province. The only government service that they feel more is education and health. Not only for them, if auntie goes to the clinic and sits there for the whole day, or goes to a clinic that opens once a week, and then comes back, and then she goes back home and tells the employer that, no, there was no doctor, I'm supposed to come the next week. She or they also get irritated. So health doesn't only impact on the auntie, it impacts on everything. So that's why anyone, everyone is got a public sympathy, no matter what. Even whether you are rich, you are not using a public service, but if anyone has been done wrong, there's been a flaw in the public system, we fail that person, it becomes an outcry. So that's why for us, in terms of the response. Now, why am I so much into that? Because the first is the health. That's why we are saying, when we started, there was what we call the health net points. Meaning, if you have got a checkup, like going to the next level of the hospital, like George or whatever, or coming to here in Cape Town, some of the people have to go and wait under the boom for our bus, minibus, to take them there, starting probably, because you have to be by 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock the latest, let's say if you're going to go to Groteskill. And then they have to be all of them back to the same bus being there. So that's why as early as from midnight, others 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, depending, St. Brock and whatever, all of those. But some of them will be in under the area under the bomb where there's no safety waiting for it. So the first thing that I say that, although actually that is a provincial initiative, it's not a national initiative. In some of the provinces, they don't even have that for their health net. So for us, that's why we say that make it safer for Auntie Sarah. Cancer cannot save under the bomb midnight. It cannot be. So what they've done, they look in every district, they look in terms of the partnership with the municipality, if there's a nearby a municipal hall or whatever that is open, with the churches, where the churches, some of them say, no, they can sit here, we've got a caretaker who can open up. In the Magisfontein, the Milner Hotel, the reception, they say, can sit at the reception. In Bito, the private hospital said, no, they can wait, but we're not aware. So they've created a list of the areas, whether safe or not, which is we can even share with you yours. I think Carol, at the time Carol was there, we shared with that in terms of how we have made other areas safer. And also we asked the hospitals where they are supposed to be, that at least they must hurry so that no one can delay others, because they must go back there. And then we have done informal arrangements, because if I must state, informal arrangements. For those, if there's an area where there are only two or three, and they are almost both in the area, there might be more or less in the same farm or same street, like the Melville, where it's just the same street. So they can be fetched from directly from home, instead of them waiting there. So that one part. And then secondly, availability and accessibility is not the same thing. For us, we offer a comprehensive package of care, primary care, which is inclusive of the medical doctors, which actually, in terms of the national South African system, it is not necessary because you are nurse-driven, doctor-oriented, supported. So there's no need, it's not a must that there must be a medical doctor at a primary healthcare clinic. That doctor might be here at a, maybe at a community day center where all the resources, if they are day, on a Wednesday for this one, on a whatever, they don't have to be here. But the mere fact that for us, in the main clinics, there is a full-time, so it's a plus. Meaning, it's not only the service is available, but also there's accessibility to the other part of the comprehensive care. And then in addition, whilst in some areas you might want not to, like in your area, and I've stolen them, where you, others, ideally you'll want to have a physical clinic instead of a mobile. But the problem that most of the land doesn't belong to the government to build a clinic. So you have to negotiate with the farmers. As a result, with the swollen dam, the new clinic, with the farmers, with the farmers, voluntarily, we're not paying them anything. They appointed, they've got new, brand new clinic, they appointed their own staff, they are doing the same thing that they did, the others in Wittenberg for the Dutoy farms. Same thing that they did in Masikama for the Lutzville. Same thing that now the Krabo farmers, that they volunteered to do that, because what they understand is that what is the use of when all their workers go all the way, they sit there all day, then I have problems, I'm not going to, so that's what they've done. So the whole issue of public-private partnership. So what I'm getting at, currently you might get some of the clinics where they might open one day for now, for that mobile. But we do make an arrangement for, in case, for example, on that Thursday that they're not supposed to be there, at least they could be able to have that access. So we are getting there, but there are also some of the challenges we have. And then in others, we are extending some of the extended hours. Like we are exploring for George where, as we did in Krabo, because you question in Parliament, you question about the Krabo, you ask us why only we bring all about the Krabo only. We do have some of the possibility of extending hours. For example, where, like in Slang Refit Clinic, where you add another day. If they open 2 days, you open 3 days. And then where, like in the George, in the Parks, Power Stop, where you say that, or even in Timberlake, where you say that, at the Fridays, at the end of the month, that's where probably people are so busy and whatever. So instead of closing at 4, close at 7. So we're exploring some of those, where you might not necessarily have to have a new clinic, but you need probably to extend. So primary health care, strengthening is part of actually what forms part of the bulk of the universal health coverage. If it was, most of the people are sick, they need interventions at this level. Very few people only need up to, they have to have a transplant, heart transplant, going to fruit skin and whatever. They need that kind of a level. Hence, we have to strengthen those. Plus, also, don't forget that we have got school services, health services. We go to primary school and grade R, our bus goes there. Every child, grade R in primary school, there will be eyes being seen, they get spectacles, they get something, so don't only look at the clinics level. We have community health workers, actually now in those farms, they go to the communities themselves, they go there to the houses. So we have got a whole lot of a package. And we have got SIPLA also, they wanted also together with Stellenbosch University as part of Ugwanda, I'm thinking of Swellendam, where they've also explored how can they appoint farmers, like the Stellenbosch, like the SIPLA, they have also they appoint more doctors from their money, which will be able to manage.
Thank you, Koli.
Must never be worried about.
Thank you, Minister. I think the member will be able to sleep very well this evening. Minister, thank you very much. Department, thank you so much for the presentation and the briefing and all the answering of the questions. I think with many challenges, we can safely say that we are in good hands. Thank you that we will be able to digest and eat this elephant piece by piece, as we are not all health professionals. But thank you, because we can see that you have a passion, you have a drive and total commitment towards the health system in this province. So thank you very much. We will see you very soon. I'm sure there's many more questions from the members, so we will invite you back shortly. Thank you very much for your time.
Refreshments
outside, everybody, and we will be back at 11.
Yeah, as a committee.
Good morning, Donald. Thank you very much for your presentation. Do you maybe have a card for me? Just so I can have your position in the department. I need. Oh, that's perfect. No, go ahead.
No, but you did this.
No, you're welcome. Must you tell us what it is? Must fix it with the chair.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that'd be great.
Hi, Debbie, it's Chris here. We finished at the standing committee. I just want to check whether, what is ours here? Is it the laptop and the mouse or what else? And then is there a bag? Yeah, I don't know. So these guys have to ask. Yeah? Okay, so we're breaking for tea now. Then maybe they can come and just fetch it. Yeah, they can come now. They will come in the next 5 minutes or 10 minutes and they can pick it up. Good, because I don't know what was here with the number four.
I don't see the bag.
I don't see the bag yet. Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. see you later.
Okay, see you.
My question about the weather.
Okay. Dit reën waar dit reën en die wind waai waar hy waai.
There's no elections, member man. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, and the offices just announced it.
Maybe next year
there'll be.
And I hope that, you know, when we do one of those study tours, that we would have insight and we would go to a developmental country and not to a first world country, because we don't.
Yeah.
We far, far, far behind in terms of first world. So we must go to developmental where they have progress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, for example, she mentioned Ghana for this Inish,
for
maybe
the universal
health care.
Yeah.
Because if you go now to France or Germany or US, really you cannot measure up
to
them.
I also say in Africa we need to go to Ghana, could be one, Burundi could be one, because they have emerged from this. You know, that could be another country. That
Zimbabwe, in terms of education,
Zimbabwe. Yeah.
Their education outcomes and all.
We shouldn't go to Germany.
No.
We don't learn.
It's just a holiday.
Where is the menu?
Social development next week is the pretty Monday. That appointment of the children. I'm going to send the notice today. You are also a member there. So it was decided yesterday, so the briefing is next week. So
there's no public hearing on that.
No, no public hearing. It was
because
done by.
Because it was done in our time.
Yes, but what we are going to do now is just to appoint, which is to advertise, and the committee now must shortlist and the interview, and when they are done, send the recommendation to the premier.
Members, can we settle down? We need to start, please. Just go outside. Members, let's go ahead. Time is a bit against us. In terms of the what was presented by the department as well as the minister, do the members have any recommendations or resolutions that we will take in this regard? Now is the opportunity for you to raise them.
The National Development Plan.
Member Barnes?
I'm not sure. I didn't get my answer to on the thing that I was asking about outsourcing. So I wanted to know if there's a possibility, perhaps it's placed as a recommendation to look at it. I haven't got an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, remember they spoke about insourcing, they are doing their own thing and they are outsourcing some stuff, so, and their budget cut whatsoever. So I was just, I don't know, I'm not sure how to put it.
So
if
you
wanted to
be,
to be submitted, they must respond in writing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I need
the response. All right. So we will ask for a written response in that regard. You happy, member? Anything from your side, member Kejo? You happy, member Allen?
Just one question, and it's a biased question. If I can probably get the information on Google, but if I can get information with regard to the learning sites in Manenberg and in Nova Park, I would like to go and visit. Seeing it's within my...
So we will also request that information from the department
and
distribute it.
Who is the head over there and the person I can contact in order to set it up?
Learning sites for what?
The learning sites for the Carol and the Lindy Dignity.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Okay, we have captured that. Thank you, member. Member Bota?
Chair, I just want to latch out on to member, what the members asked now with regards to the, what that was the laundry service that the members spoke about. And maybe just to attach to that, what she is requesting is to say also as part of that, just for the department to show us the comparison of outsourcing and in-house in terms of finances, what is the difference, so that we can see it there. I just wanted to match up to that. And then in terms of one, the sites that he is talking about, maybe for us to at some point in time maybe do an oversight in terms of what, so that we can see for ourselves what's happening there.
And in the two areas?
In the two areas mentioned,
no,
Manenberg and Nova Park.
I'm just biased in the areas that I selected. but
members through the, through the chair, please.
So sorry.
Thank you, Member Allen. Member Winfogel, anything from your side, a recommendation or resolution based on the presentations that was given to us this morning? Is there any follow-up, perhaps a written submission that you would want the department to give to us that can be distributed, or any other question that you perhaps did not have the opportunity to raise?
I think I'm covered, Chair, but I agree with one of the members about the oversight.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, members. So that concludes that part of the agenda, members. We are immediately going over to considering and adopting our minutes of the 4th of June, which were distributed to members. Members, page 1 of the minutes, are we happy? Page 2 of the minutes, can we get the proposal? Member Bota, second by Member Allen, thank you very much. And then, members, item 4 on the agenda, we need now to consider our committee program going forward. You are in the position of one, as it is on the 22nd of July 2019. So today we can tick off. Then our next engagement will be on the 7th of August. Any input from your side, member? Member Bota?
Chair, maybe can we consider this oversight of what we just spoken about in terms of our recommendation, maybe for the 7th?
Can we agree to an oversight visit on the 7th of August? And we, can we decide on...
Next week?
No, it will always be the slot.
Yeah. It will always be this slot, yes. So are we in agreement for an oversight visit, and where exactly are we going to, members?
Chair, I suppose we have to be considerate in terms of the members of this committee, whether they are in another committee that falls in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So maybe we should speak about that first and how that then impacts on other oversight visit in the morning.
Members? Any other committee obligations on the day, in the afternoon?
I'm checking it. I have one.
What time?
What time, member?
In the afternoon.
Four, at two?
Yeah,
okay, which one is that?
The fourth afternoon fellowship.
Okay, that's member Allen. Okay.
I'm impacted as well because I sit on the
room. Is that at what time?
At two.
But see, if we do the oversight, yeah, we'll go early, then we come back before one.
Yeah. Okay, because we will always have that challenge. Yeah. There will be meeting afterwards.
True.
Okay, members, we will just then try to schedule the engagement so that you can be back in time.
So the visit is in Manenberg, and where are we going?
We need to determine that. Are we in agreement that we're going to visit the learning sites as proposed by member Allen?
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So
it's Manenberg and Hanover.
And Hanover, yeah.
Gee, I just want to say this is time and bias of member Allen.
He grabbed the opportunity with both hands and feet.
Thank you.
Members, next engagement, the 14th of August. Members, we are going through the dates on our program going forward. Is there anything that you would like to slot into that allocated time, then you are welcome to do so, to propose so. So the 14th, the 21st of August, the 2nd or the 6th of September, we will have Constituency Week. The 11th of September, we will meet again as a committee. The 18th of September again. 23rd to 29th September is Constituency Week, and then we have slots for October in terms of our annual report period, and considering of a bill in October as well. Members, we have now dates when our committee will take place. We have now scheduled one oversight visit. Perhaps we must just go back and think about any other visits or anything outside of normal committee. Just let our minds go for a bit, cause we don't now decide in a hurry, and perhaps. Member Botha?
Chair, if with your indulgence, if I can just propose for the 14th of August, and I think in terms of this department, we have had challenges in terms of EMS, that program, as well as the forensic pathology services. We have had pressures, and maybe we should just ask the department to come and brief us on the status of, in terms of those programs. So I would propose that for the 14th of August.
Very important. Thank you, member. So we will ask the department back then on the 14th of August, in terms of EMS and forensic pathology services, to come and brief us on the status of the 14th. So members, can we then agree that we adopt the program as it is, and should anything arise, we will communicate with our procedural officer in that regard and distribute the necessary information. Are we happy? Member Botha?
Chair, sorry, but I'm just thinking, you know, as saying what I said and thinking about it, I know that the department opened the state-of-the-art pathology services now in, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That was so maybe after the 14th, if we can embark on an oversight again to that forensic pathology lab. Chair, I want to, in terms of the 18th of September, and we've spoken about it in the programming, there is the proposed NCOP visit week, so we need to take cognizance of that for the 18th of September. Then, Chair, and I'm just taking off the health member hat, and I'm putting the education chairperson hat on. As the Education Standing Committee was going to send, or is in the process of sending an invite to
the Standing Committee on Health to do a to join the Standing Committee of Education to an oversight visit to Red Cross Hospital. But that is now proposed for the 10th of September and not the 11th of September. So I don't know whether you would consider it after you receive the invitation, but I'm also then proposing a, you know, a visit together with education, but now in the education slot on the 10th, which is in the afternoon, and I don't know how it impacts on other members here, but yeah, for the 10th, and then instead of having the meeting then on the 11th.
Okay, thank you, member. We take note of that. Let us receive the invitation and we consider it accordingly. Your comment on the forensic lab visit, state of the art facility. Perhaps we can go there and have our briefing on site.
Yes,
so we kill two birds with one stone. For the 14th of August.
So on the 14th we do the visit.
Yes.
And the briefing.
At the same time, yes.
Okay, that means the 21st is still open.
Yes.
Okay.
For normal committee.
Yes.
For now. Okay. So members, as soon as we receive the invite from education, we will consider that and how it impacts on the 11th of September. So we can close that matter. Thank you, members. Yes, members, I just need to bring under your attention the Office of the Health Standards Compliance has sent us a communication about a visit that will take place during October 2019. The information will be circulated to you, but this is done nationally across provinces where the National Minister embark on outreach to all provinces. So we as the Health Standing Committee will be part of such engagement. But as I said, I'm only mentioning it to you now. We will confirm in due course. So we also just still need to apply as to exactly what this visit entails going forward. So we will speak to this at our next engagement, but the information will be forwarded to you beforehand as well. So members, I think that concludes our engagement for today. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your valuable input. There's still a lot to come. So as I said, let's eat this elephant piece by piece. And thank you very much. Your input is valued. You must enjoy your day. Thank you.
So if we go to this place, we'll have to leave at 8 on that day. That's to allow us time to travel. I don't think it's fine. I think it's all things about around to accommodate the briefing and then. But I'll just notice, then I'll just
back.
Forward it to you just
to
for you to check.
Well.
Then we'll be back on time. Usually when we do the visit, it's either we eat outside. I do have the credit card. The credit card is that I can always use. Maybe members after the visit they go to a restaurant and maybe we can have lunch. Usually we have it here.
Okay.
We normally meet here at Dopio because it was around, but now I notice that they are closed.
Oh.
So I don't know what happened.
Mm.
So we can look for a restaurant around, then from the visit we go to that restaurant, or it can be any restaurant that you want to go.
Yeah, I think you can make that. I don't know the restaurants around here, but you can make that arrangement.
Okay.
Because
we'll
as the members come back into the, they must go to the engagement.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much, Monday.
Okay, sure, thank you. And
this is
Did you take your register?
Actually, no.
But I think you must...
No, I've got it. Yeah, maybe do you have any additional documents that you're willing to give me? Because I know you sent the APP to... Right?
It was a presentation, everything of today. So I don't have any additional documents.
Okay.
But if you want the register, we can make a copy.
Could you please?
Yeah. of the register for you because people didn't find.
Yeah, I thought it was actually kept there by the audio and then.
Yeah. I'll look for it. Maybe you can come with me.
Yes, I will, definitely. Thank you so much.
Okay, this is your.
Yeah, it's not mine.